Well, hello and welcome to this Wednesday webcast on the Adoption and Fostering podcast with me, Scott Cassin-Rennie, himself, Al Coates. Haha. Yeah, shut up, because you're just going to chat all night. I know you are. And we're joined tonight by Doctor Paul Shuttleworth.
You don't have to say doctor, yes, but thank you.
It's not what I said before we started.
Yeah, don't try and make us look bad. Come on. Welcome, Paul. And everybody good? Everybody okay?
I have my caveat to say before.
Yeah, you do. I'm just asking if everybody's okay before I let you run loose with your caveat. So
don't worry, I'll keep to the point. I'm conscious that we're talking about kinship care this weekend because kinship care week. I want to say fortnight, but it's kinship care week. What I'm really conscious of is that none of us are kinship carers. And I just want to kind of reassure people that we've tried actually quite hard to get some kinship carers on. And I think that it feels a bit disingenuous not to have any on, but we've tried across, I think, four different carers, and for there's lots of really complicated reasons, but actually in some ways it reflects some of the difficulties of the issues for kinship carers in relation to access to technology, publicity, awareness of what is out there for them as kinship carers. So yeah, please don't come on and go, well, there's no flipping kinship carers on, so what, you know, it's all people, like it's all men, middle-aged, we're all white middle-aged men and talking about kinship care.
It's yourself in middle-aged, thank you very much.
I think we need to go on a diversity course.
clearly.
I think kinship carers as well, I think they actually just want to get on in raising their families, to be honest, without having to put themselves forward all the time, without having to be anything to do with social work all the time, all of that kind of stuff. It's the reality of it.
Because if Scott and I had put something out and said, hey, adoption week, does anyone want to come on webcast? Yeah. We would have four or five people would have come to us. We wouldn't have had to approach anyone. And that sort of reflects the nature of kinship care, that people find themselves in the circumstances as opposed to choose those circumstances.
Absolutely.
Oh, damn, we're good this week, aren't we?
I'll tell you. Anyway,
so it's me. It's my influence.
Yeah, Dr. Paul Shuttleworth.
You don't have to keep calling me Doctor.
Dr. Paul. Should we just call you Dr. Paul? I think Dr. Paul sounds much. It's a little bit shorter. It's easy to say. So introduce yourself. Tell us who you are, what you do, where you're from. Blah blah blah. Go on.
So I'm in Brighton. Well, I'm in Hove actually, which means more to people that live in Hove. And what do I do? Well, because Hove like to think that they're slightly different from Brighton, because it's more kind of slightly more kind of Pilates and book clubs and stuff like that. I don't know.
Find it to hold Brighton.
Remember, Social Work England are listening. If you're conscious that there are rules and regulations about them.
Yeah, sorry. You can edit
profession into.
Edit it out.
It says live in the corner, so no, that can happen. Sorry.
I was in practice for 10 years and in children and families 10 years. Really good 10 years up in Scotland, actually, in Edinburgh for some time. And then I came down to Brighton and Hove, actually, my sister had a kid and I kind of wanted to be around that. And then I spent the last two in kinship care, and I was just really, really interested in it. And then I got the opportunity to do a PhD. So I went back to learning because I love learning. And what I was really interested in is a lot of the times we always talk about, you know, getting the views of children. But actually, sometimes it's just a little kind of tick box at the end or a bit at the end of the assessment or whatever it might be when we're doing kind of a lack review or something like this. And I just didn't think that we should have children's views at the center. And I was really keen to explore that because I also think sometimes when we talk about what adults think children need, actually that doesn't necessarily match up to what children think they need. So what matters to children rather than what we think matters to children. I just wanted to see if actually they would rise to the occasion, and they did in my study. So that was just really, really amazing. I can give you an example kind of a bit later on. So now I'm doing some lecturing at Sussex. I'm doing some social work for the local authority. I'm just basically want it all. I wanted to do it all. And I'm also a professional officer at BASWA. So so I'm doing all of those kind of different things. Yeah, really busy. And also trying to do publications as well. And also, yeah, it's all good, but it is really busy. But that's how I like to, like to keep it, really.
No, that's amazing. I'm really intrigued because actually I think you're the first person I've ever heard talk in relation to what about kinship children? Where is their voice? Because Scott and I, probably over the last couple of years, we've kind of tried to raise the voice of adopted people. And they're quite quiet, but they're not, there's lots of views about that and they're hard to access. And there's lots of complicated questions, but actually the voices of kinship children, I mean, the voices of kinship carers, as we said, are quiet. I can't think of any time where I've sort of had even the conversation about what the kinship children in kinship care think.
Yeah.
So was that literally just it? You just thought, where is this voice?
It's not just children in kinship care. So I started looking into kind of things like childhood studies and all of this kind of stuff. And without going into kind of the whole philosophy of this, that and everything, you know, children, we often in social work, we often see children as vulnerable, as having, you know, having trauma that we don't want to resurface that trauma by asking them too many questions. We don't want to give them too much information because they might not understand us, all of this kind of stuff. And I think that's why we're a little bit kind of apprehensive about asking children. And my kind of thoughts were, having spoken to children in my social work career, it was kind of like, well, actually, these kids know what's going on much more than we give them credit for. And if they don't know what's going on, they will fill in the pieces, and they will usually fill in the pieces wrong. We all do that, don't we? So if we all just kind of make things up in our heads when we're kind of lying in bed trying to get to sleep. It's like, oh, well, this is going to happen or this is going to happen. So it was just a case of actually, it's probably better to kind of inform children rather than let them kind of make up pieces and actually allow them to participate in what their lives should be. It seemed like a reasonable thing to do.
You say that, but we don't live in a reasonable world, do we? Gathering the views of children. So did you struggle to get ethical approval for that? Because that seems like people would go, oh, no, you can't, you know, we're not used to talking to kids.
It's so bizarre. It's so bizarre because people always ask me that, and I'm never quite sure why. So, yeah. Sorry for
that. Maybe we don't understand. No, and that's fine, Dr. Paul.
Yeah,
you know, put me back in my box. That's right.
No. I generally it's about exploring the reasons why, and it is that thing about seeing kids as vulnerable and seeing them as not kind of able. So there are studies around which takes the views of children. You know, Julie Selwyn, for example, who's a friend of the show. Is that correct? Yeah.
Oh, we like you. You could come back.
Yeah. Oh. Listen. I think someone else, I'm doing my washing up and stuff. You spice up my life like a spice girl or whatever. Anyway, what was I talking about? talking about Jimmy. You have to contain me a little bit. We'll edit that bit out again, won't we?
I can see your career literally just going.
No, he's a doctor. That doesn't happen to doctors.
Yeah, it doesn't happen to doctors, no.
We'll
keep you on track, sorry.
Thank you. So in terms of ethical approval, it was just, in terms of those voices, sometimes there are voices in there, but it's usually with adult voices. And actually what we do is we use children's voices to back up what the adults are saying rather than the other way around. And it's really, really interesting in terms of those power dynamics. We just see adults as more credible, really, don't we? For whatever reason it would be. Yeah, now, you know, in our daily lives, children can be, I don't have children. I mean, children can get things wrong and even lie, but so can adults. I mean, you know, just look at the current government, for example.
Every sentence you're setting fire to your prospects.
So it was just looking at those things and saying, actually, let's focus on the kids. Let's focus on what they have to say about kinship care, because we really have troubles at the moment in trying to determine where it fits in with things. Is it a service? Is it a placement service that we would normally say in terms of permanence? How do they view that permanence? So do they view it in terms of this is a substitute family? Well, no, they don't, because actually it's remaining within the family, but it's a new part of the family that they're going to. And as adults, as researchers and as social workers, we constantly have troubles of trying to place where we put the responsibility. So do we then put the responsibility back onto the families solely and peer group supports? Or do we look and say, well, actually, you know, policy has a responsibility, services have a responsibility as well. And there's constant battles between that argument throughout all kinship care literature. So I just thought, well, do you know what? Let's put all of that to one side for a little bit. And let's ask kids what they think and see if they can come up with, you know, another way in or another kind of solution to all of this. Let's see what they think and take that into consideration. So the ethical...
I'm going to stop you there because I'm conscious that probably people are listening and... Can we define kinship care? Like I said, even as a starting point, we're just presuming that people know what we're talking about.
So. Yeah, sure.
That's our fault. We should have... When we say kinship care, because we've got special guardianship, which is a legal framework, legal status, yeah. I guess, and we've got kinship care. What are the difference between the two? Are we talking about the same thing by a different name or...?
So special guardianship is one of the orders that we know that we can normally use. So breaking it down, kinship care is when children... can't remain in the care of their previous primary carers. Normally, I mean, it could be for many different reasons, but normally it's kind of due to abuse or neglect. So we look within the family setting. So it can be related family members, it could be step family members, or it could be kind of family friends, not kind of people that, you know, that you meet every so often, but people that you would regard as your family.
Yeah.
And that's something that children kind of start talking about as well in terms of what does family mean. And maybe we kind of constrain our views about what family actually is too much. And they've actually got great ideas about what family can mean. So you have formal kinship care. So that's when it's kind of there's been social work intervention. And that's where you go to a kind of orders, or there can be foster kinship carers. So they go to panels, for example, which aren't necessarily suited to what kinship care can be. Or they can go to court and they can come under a special guardianship order. Now, these orders and how they're supported is at the discrepancy of, they shouldn't be at the discrepancy of local authorities, but unfortunately they can be. So there's kind of a, you know, postcode lottery or whatever you want to kind of call it around that. And that's a major source of contention. I think at the moment
Is that getting better? If I look back 5 years, kinship was not talked about. It is more talked about, but nowhere near when you consider the level, because could you give us an approximate number of how many children are in kinship arrangements?
So, unfortunately, we can only go from the last census. Thank you.
All of them.
All of them. Which is in 2011. You can do kind of extrapolations if you're very clever. So I did them, for example. And you can do...
Doctor. You can do,
doctor. So around over 200,000, I guess. And that's using kind of, looked after children. We know that 95% of kinship care arrangements are informal. So they haven't had social work, intervention. Mm. They haven't necessarily had any kind of care orders. And there's a huge reason why that is. And, you know, that might be linked to why we were unable to get some kinship carers here tonight. It's just actually people just want to get on with and doing it. And also they feel pretty much scrutinized by the system, by social workers and all of these things. That's not without, by the way, that's not out with the scope of reality for a lot of these carers, because a lot of these carers are kind of told, well, if you come to me with loads and loads of problems, then we will just simply move the kids to somewhere where they're safer, or they're more, you know. So that's why carers are kind of a bit reticent to come, you know, to come for support.
I would say that rings true. I mean, I sat on a panel where we did adoption and fostering, and I recall, I mean, this is a couple of years ago now, but I recall the kinship SGO kind of thing starting to come through. And what was quite clear when I was sat on that panel was that it was almost, and I use my words a little bit carefully when I say this, but it was almost a foregone conclusion that the children would go to that kind of kinship care or SGO arrangement, because there was a real focus on that for local authorities to kind of make sure that children were kept within the family. But what I found was it was very difficult to make a decision based on how you were trained as a panel member, if that makes sense. So we were trained in adoption and fostering. We weren't trained in kind of taking into account the fact that these families were being made as a result of being biologically related, potentially, you know, well, they were, but not being prepared for maybe what would happen in a year, 2 years' time in terms of behaviours and, you know, keeping them up to speed in terms of things that were going on, their availability, because some, you know, I'm not tarring them all with the same brush, but some of them, you know, they still work full-time, both of them. They're trying to bring up children who potentially may, you know, have, I hate using the word behavioural, but it's the easiest way to explain it, behavioural difficulties, and, you know, they've been affected by the kind of trauma and the loss of what they've had, in the same way adopted and foster children have. So has that changed in local authorities, do you think, or is that kind of still the same? Okay.
I don't think so, and I think, you know, I think one of the things that needs to start happening is we need to see kinship care for what it is. So too often we compare, let me go back a bit before I answer that question, and I'll answer Al's question before.
Sorry, which too many questions.
Too many questions.
which was, is there enough recognition, for example? And why is there more recognition? And there is more recognition now, which is really great. And that's because of people like Grandparents West, so Kinship Organization, for example, the really powerful work that they do, and the work that organizations like CORE and BAF do, the work that Family Rights Group do. Yeah. So you know, that's the reason. Sorry, what Scott was, and now I'm jumping to the other questions. I'm very confused. And your question was?
My question was more around, in say 5-6 years since kinship and SGOs kind of became more prevalent to adoption, shall we say, when they used to go through local authorities, it was almost a given that it was just going to happen, and but nobody was prepared for that. You know, nobody was trained. Nobody, you know, blah blah blah. Has that changed? Are they now providing that support?
So I'm remembering why I linked it to the previous question, because actually what we start doing is we start contextualizing it in terms of adoption and fostering. The organization starts, and this is where I start getting into a bit of trouble, actually, because the organizations quite rightly ask for kind of parity in terms of the support, the allowances, as the same as foster carers. Addition into the adoption support fund, which if you have an SGO you can get, which is quite right. But it's all within the confounds of actually adoption and fostering, so we're trying to fit it in, and it's often described as fitting in a square peg into a round hole. We're trying to fit it in, and it's not going to fit. It just won't fit. So the more that we go down that route, unfortunately, you know, we're still not going to solve what it is. So we need to start thinking about what kinship care is as something on its own, rather than comparing it to adoption and fostering, because it's just not going to work. And it hasn't worked in terms of legislation, because the legislation in terms of the Children Act is very much geared around, you know, adoption and fostering. The fostering standards very much geared around kind of fostering standards. And what do? We either kind of lower thresholds, or we do we make concessions, or these children still need to be safe. And the other thing that, and this is undoubtedly really important, is these relationships within these families. There's so much for these carers to consider, because first of all, a lot of the times, you know, the majority of carers are grandparents. Just over half, I think, possibly more. But you have sibling carers as well, etc. But to know that your child has been unable to bring up a child is something that you will undoubtedly struggle with.
Mm.
Undoubtedly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially when, you know, we're living in a world where a lot of responsibility is placed on us. You know, what did you do wrong rather than what did, you know, the context that we live in, what's that like for us? So these relationships, the complex relationships, I think just maintaining those relationships, especially the children say, you know, that's really difficult for all of the family, and they can kind of feel that. But they manage it in really, really nuanced ways, actually, these kids. They manage it in really, really clever ways, I think, in terms of keeping those connections.
I mean, I was reflecting, I've got a friend who's, her and her husband are grandparents, kinship carers. And one of them is in his 70s, one in the 60s, and they're having to work into their old age beyond retirement just to kind of support the needs of their younger children. But I'm really... But the complexity of that whole dynamic is just so outside of the nuclear family model. So I'd be interested to know how do children then keep, what are children saying about that kind of that complexity? Because there must be a point where those children go, well, hang on, it's not that unusual, but it's not the same as most of my friends.
Yeah. And one of the hardest things that I said to a kid, you know, one of the hardest questions was, you know, are you different? It's just a really horrible question, actually, to ask someone, isn't it?
But I was going to say, you missed that day at social work. Yeah.
And do you feel different? But the answers I got back were just, you know, because they didn't, but they did, but they didn't, but they didn't, did. It's the same as all of us if we ask that question to anyone, you know, and they're struggling with their, you know, in terms of how they fit in, but how they don't. But we're constantly doing that, you know, and actually it's the way that they manage that. That's what's important, not whether they feel different or not, because that's what we all are struggling with. So it's the ways of managing how they feel different. So it's the in-between thing. And I'm all about, you know, in terms of social work, in terms of our lives, in terms of everything, it's all about navigating those in-between spaces. That's what it is. You know, it's not just a case of, should it be kind of support or intervention? It's on the scale. It's not just a case of, you know, are you with your family or out with your family? It's on a scale. It's not a case of, are you different or not different? It's on a scale. And that's why those questions about what matters, those spaces, those in-between spaces became the real focus, because it's looking at how they do that. And they do it in amazing ways.
So come on, share us.
Tell me.
Like you're teasing us. Or do people have to buy your book? Is that what you're all about? I presume you have a book.
They have to read my 150,000 words. No, they don't. So, for example. No, they do. Sorry. I'm getting confused now. So, think about trampolines. Okay, so a lot of these kids that I saw, they had trampolines, for example. So this whole idea of independence, are we independent or are we not? They're literally boundaried space. They normally have nets on them where you can be yourself. They're also social places where they're places that you can be yourself. And I've just found it really interesting how they use that. They're also in the garden where you can be away from the house and you can be away from the family, but you still have some connection. So they're constantly navigating those in-between spaces by being in those in-between spaces. So whenever I talk to them about what matters to them, they would say things like pets, for example. Now, that's not to say that every kinship carer needs to have a pet, or that we should be providing pets to every kinship carer or anything. No, that's just silly, right? But what's really important is the relationship they had with pets, so that matters to them. And they put a timestamp on when they were talking about their pets. So they were saying, this is my dog Ruffles or whatever, I don't know what dog's name is, and he you know, he's been with the family for 8 years, and he was a little bit scared when he started off, but, you know, we settled him in, and now we accept him for who he is. And you're just going, whoa, wait a minute. You're actually moving through your life and seeing how people react to the pet and how they care for the pet, how they accept the pet. And you're taking that on board and thinking about your own permanence, your own identity within the family. It was just amazing, amazing, amazing stuff. When they were talking about contact, some of the kids just didn't want face-to-face contact. They were talking about connections. They were talking about using different things, whether that be letters they never sent, or whether it be pictures, or whether it be talking to their aunts about, I don't know, about, you know, family resemblances, all of these really, really amazing things. And I remember this one kid, and the first time I went to see her, she had a picture of her mum, and it was up on the shelf. And then I went again, and I said, oh, so tell me. And it was turned around. I was like, what? Tell me why that's turned around. She's like, oh, I'm just having an argument with my mum at the moment. So, you know, I don't want to just look at her face. But she had it there. Again, they're navigating, she hadn't broken it. But again, they're navigating all of these different things in really, really kind of nuanced ways. Mm. And if we just kind of tap into that, because actually what they're doing is they're doing things like thinking about contact. They're thinking about permanency. They're permanency planning. They're actually doing the work. So when I relate it back to what I said at the very beginning in terms of, you know, we often don't take children seriously, I don't understand why we don't, because they're the ones that are doing the work, and we should be tapping. They're a great resource there. You know, we should be tapping into that rather than going off in our old, you know, we know better, Dr. Paul, adult-centric ways.
Yeah. And I was just going to ask about that as well, because I want to take you back to what you said about we're trying to slot kinship care into the fostering adoption. What about the families where... So I'm thinking of my old, like, two of my sons come from a large family, and there was kinship arrangements for some of the family, and my two children were placed for adoption. How, I mean, like, I guess what I'm asking is, long story short, because I'll waffle on for ages, the experience is the same, but but up to a point, and then that changes. So, you know, they've stayed with kind of within the biological nucleus of the family, but, you know, 2, 3, 4 of them may not have done. I'm not challenging you on this, but I'm just saying, is it too different in terms of their experiences? Is that why we've kind of put them in, trying to shoehorn everybody into that kind of square peg round hole kind of thing, or is it something different?
I think it's kind of ease, to be honest. First of all, I think it's secondly, there's a lot to, I'm going to tank my career now again, so I think there's lots to do in terms of finance. It's really, really attractive for us as cash strapped local authorities to use kinship care as an easy way out, and a cheap way out. You know, we don't have to train carers that much. We can kind of lead them to it. If there's problems, then we just go back to it and threaten them or whatever. We don't do that, thank goodness. Certainly in terms of Brighton and Hove, for example, where I've worked, they do amazing work in terms of training carers, being there, supporting them, giving them a flat fee as well. So it's not means tested, for example. All of these things, they're really, really important, and they really, really, first of all, they save time, but they actually make families trust the services that are there to kind of support them. So I just think it's kind of ease for so many different ways that we just kind of put it as a service, rather than actually what these kids were saying, you know, actually, this is my family. This is about a family arrangement for me. Yes, I need it as a service as well. Because the other thing was that, you know, I don't have kids. So I go with a very kind of optimistic attitude. You know, the kids that I see are my lovely nieces who kind of come round, and I can let them kind of feed them sugar and let them swing on lampshades and whatever they want to do, pretty much. Send them home. Let my sister deal with them all kind of wired and ready to not sleep and all of that kind of stuff. So I've got a very kind of liberal attitude towards children. You know.
You do. Clearly, doctor.
Yeah. I have no idea.
I guess as well, what I was thinking then was later on in life, because, you know, I'm without going into great detail, you know, we're now in a stage where I've got adult children who are reconnecting with their birth siblings. And obviously their experiences are different. And what I'm kind of wondering is, and it comes on to a question I have in a minute, is really about what are we looking at in terms of those families who've been kind of broken up, because they have been broken up effectively, haven't they? And, you know, this one's gone to aunt, this one's gone to uncle, this one's gone to grandma, and then this one's been adopted or long-term fostered or whatever. And I guess I'm just thinking about the long-term kind of thing of this, with bringing them all back together with all those different experiences once they've kind of been broken up, and how that's going to affect them. I mean, I'm not asking you for the answer to this. I'm just saying that, you know, is this something that you're thinking about for the kind of future, or is it something that you've thought about already? I mean, you know.
So the place that this kind of led me is in terms of kind of thinking around contact. And I suppose I just did so we call it family time now, don't we? I guess in terms of social work, that's where we're moving along. I don't think we quite got it right in terms of calling it family time either. Yeah. I contextualize it in terms of connections and keeping those connections safe, but also live, because kids have those connections, whether people are physically present or not, especially siblings. So I was talking to the kids about, you know, well, tell me about who's, and they were kind of saying, oh, but this person, that person, you know, they're not really my sibling, but they are, and blah, 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 and all of this kind of stuff. But they're telling me things like, you know, well, they give me things like, even though they're not here, I remember them because they love me. So they give me things like love, or they taught me how to ride a bike. And all of these things about keeping connections, you know, really, really live. In the way that they want it to be done, and they want it to be done safely as well. So they want, you know, and they also understand that that's going to change. They also understand, because we talked about the difference between adults and children, they also understand that they shouldn't be having the final decisions in these things. So it's not a case of, again, coming back to let kids run riot and all this kind of stuff. Actually, safety was really, really important to these kids. They'd been in some really unsafe situations. So, you know, I'm not suggesting for one minute that we should deregulate things when they need to be regulated, that we should, you know, just let things happen, when actually sometimes there needs to be some way of some bit of control there for the safety of these children. And they were really, really clear of that. But they want to be included in the conversations the same way, you know, we should be including kinship carers the same way that we should be including anyone when we're talking about something.
Yeah,
we should be including the people that have experience of that, because actually, if we delve deep enough and we have the right methodology, we are able to gather amazing bits of knowledge in terms of that.
Yeah. I mean, I find this a really refreshing conversation, because it's really child-centered. I mean, we keep dragging you back out of children, but we've had a comment from Colin Chatton, and he said, it seems that kinship care seems to be expected to do the same professional job that trained foster parents do, but with very little support compared to registered foster parents, which I think is a really interesting point. And I was thinking off the back of that, you gave the simple figure of, what, 200,000, roughly, kinship arrangements. We're talking foster care, we're talking 80,000 children in foster care, we're talking maybe 70,000 children who are adopted under 18. Mm-hmm. Kinship's the big one. Kinship outstrips the other two combined. Yeah. But it's the one that costs, well, it potentially costs nothing. But you're saying that, you know, you've got a good model there in where you are. Do you think that this is a nettle that has to be grasped? Do you think it's going to be grasped, or do you think we're just going to kind of limp along doing different sort of patchwork models?
You see, I think it's something that is being grasped, and we are beginning to recognise. And can I mention that the review or not. Is that a dirty word? The independent review.
You can tell me you like. It's just, you know, with the complaints, that's all. But.
Yeah, we'll redirect them to Dr. Paul Shuttleworth and give him your home address.
So, I think, okay, let me talk, but let me talk the positives then. The review is great because it's actually highlighting kinship care, and it's actually highlighting how little support kinship carers get. And that's quite right. Actually, we should be looking at that. We really, really should. Where I think it's missing a beat a little bit is because it's going back again into the comparison thing in terms of adoption, fostering, and all that kind of stuff. I think in terms of looking at, so when I looked at the case for change and read through it, it was just really interesting in terms of the narrative of risk that was kind of missing. And I see that a lot in kind of kinship care literature. And if the kids are saying it's important, then we need to kind of take that on board. For me, that's what I think. But also this idea of growing kinship care, I think that's a really dangerous kind of statement to kind of make, because it shouldn't be about growing kinship care. It should be making sure, you know, hopefully we've moved away from this gold standard of what's right and what's wrong in terms of children. And we know now that actually the right type of care depends on the child. It depends on the circumstances, and depends on the families. It depends on all of these different things.
I'm going to have to stop you there.
Okay.
Because you're right. We all know that.
Yeah.
But you know that the latest government manifesto said we will prioritize, you know, it put adoption front and center. And that is the government's, they may say that behind closed doors, but their manifesto says that's the gold standard adoption.
Well, it's the Nehru stuff, isn't it? You know, and all of this kind of stuff. So, yeah, you're right. We should be moving away from the... No, you're right. Yeah. We should be moving away from the gold standard. But my worry is that the case for change will bump kinship care up to the gold standard, when actually we need to look at how things work. The how rather than the what, you know? Yeah. And we can't just disaggregate. We can't just say, well, kinship care it provides better outcomes, which it can do, and you know, for kids, which it can do. But we know actually, in terms of starting, you know, the starting position for kids. So, you know, maybe actually they're going into these kinship care arrangements because, for example, they haven't had a huge amount of trauma. I don't know what it means, you know, but favorable starting points will always lead to favorable outcomes. So we don't know that it's kinship care as a thing that is making that difference. We can kind of say that, you know, for the majority of kinship care arrangements at the moment, it's doing great things for kids. But to say, actually, well, therefore, we need to grow kinship care without actually really examining what it is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's really, really scary. And the scary bit is that we still have to remember that kinship care is a cheaper option. So we don't want to be growing it for sinister reasons. I'm not suggesting that anyone's doing that, but we have to still keep that in our minds.
Yeah.
But that's a really helpful answer, because I think it is. It's the idea that rather than elevating one particular stream or strand or path, saying that the right thing for the kids, you know, what is right for this child at this time.
Yeah.
And for some children, that may be adoption, but it may be kinship.
Yeah.
And if we can achieve kinship by spending a little bit of money, that's what we should do. And it's that conversation, isn't it? But it doesn't feel, it feels like there remains a hierarchy. And like you say, if we don't want to just change this hierarchy for a different hierarchy.
This idea of needs-based assessment and needs-based support is not new, is it?
It's crazy.
You know, it should be strange, isn't it?
So, I mean, Al and I always talk about the children our generation in terms of adopted children, young people. Is there a movement within the kinship care kind of experienced people in terms of their voices? Is that happening? Because, you know, we should be coming to a point now where we've got adults coming through who've been looked after by kinship care and should be able to kind of say, right, this is how it is. This is what my experience is, and this is what we need to do, and blah, blah, blah. Is that happening?
It is happening, and I think now we're getting people who have experienced kinship care, who are doing research, that are PhD researchers, for example, and have experienced different types of kinship care. So Lorna's, for example, has experienced kinship care, and also she's been a kinship carer, sibling kinship carer, for example. So we're getting people through that have an interest in this. So I've got a professional interest. Mm. That developed into a child-centered interest, yeah. And then we have different people. So, yeah, we're coming out on force. So watch your backs.
Well, you say it's really interesting because I guess a lot of my experience of adoption has sort of took me into a route of supporting families or adopters in relation to challenging behaviour, which then and I kind of thought, well, this is a small world. Are there other families? And that opened up the door. And discovered that actually this problem is probably much more problematic or complex within kinship arrangements. I remember one, I did one event and it was well attended, lots of people there. We were talking about complicated children. In the back corner, I probably told this story before, so sorry, Scott. In the back corner, there was a woman who was maybe in her mid to late 60s, but she was sort of like, she was quite old, but still quite fit and well. And with her was a woman who was in her late 80s, mid to late 80s. And so at half time, I went over and said, oh, hello, what are you doing here? In a nice way. And it was a grandmother and her mother who were looking after a seven-year-old who had really complex needs and was assaulting them. And okay. You kind of go, bloody hell. Mm. You know, I'm a fit, strapping young middle-aged man. And I'm struggling with this, physically struggling with this. How are you coping? And where, just really conscious that some of the needs of some of these families, that they're hidden within there, that they hide them because they just don't want to open the door to social workers again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's such a shame, isn't it? Mm. That's something we need to get better at. It's absolutely something we need to get better at. I don't know what to say. I just don't know what to say to that.
And that'll be hidden and that'll be repeated again and again and again, because we know that when children have experienced high levels of adversity, that then manifests in really complicated ways, doesn't it? And sometimes that's not pretty.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a really happy conversation. I don't know why.
Great, well done.
Down that well done, Al.
And I always get teased by my partner for smiling through all of this stuff as well. But yeah, thanks.
Is he a doctor as well?
No, he's an architect. He has no interest in what I do. I have very little interest in what he does.
Anyone could be an architect.
Well, I think what he does is draw and colour in, and he thinks all I do is talk, which is pretty much, we probably push. Right.
I used to be a draftsman, and architects are our natural enemy.
They're really boring.
Really?
Yeah, it's like oil and water, honestly. We're way off the beaten track now, Scott.
Yeah, you are. I didn't take it there. You took it there. I mean,
no.
I just want to add one thing because I think this is really, really important. So, in terms of you mentioned carers being kind of older, and when I was talking to kids, at some point, I mean, first of all, did you use different methods to talk to kids? So again, read my thesis. Please read my thesis, because there's ways of communicating with kids that I just found so useful and it'd be really great. But when I was talking to the kids, they would talk to me about death in every single time that I would talk to them, and I was just kind of fascinated by that. And my first reaction is, oh, isn't that a shame? Isn't that a shame? And then I was kind of thinking, well, actually, it's kind of good, isn't it, that they're kind of thinking in terms of these things. And when I explored these things with them, they started saying things to me like, well, if grandma dies, then what happens is we go to Auntie Jane and then I'll have to move to school, which would be quite hard, but especially if I'm kind of in the second year. But I think I'll settle in. Again, the permanency planning, they're actively permanency. This is what they're doing. But also their sense of permanence isn't just with substitute carers. It's across the family. And that's from their experiences. They don't understand permanency in the way that social workers and adults might do in terms of, right, there you go. That's what it is. They're your carers until whenever.
Yeah.
They kind of are thinking, no, as long as someone across the family or everyone across the family takes responsibility for me in terms of, then that's my permanency. That's what matters to me. That's my sense of permanency. It's not just substitute carers from one to another. Again, we've got so much to learn from these kids. It just, it astounded me and yeah.
Do you think, I mean, I'm totally opening up a whole can of worms here, like where you thought you'd got away. Do you think there's an element of community culture that impacts on the prevalence of kinship? Because we know that, for example, children from perhaps an Asian background, there's a lower representation within the care community, and that's sort of thought to potentially be because of that community culture. Do you think there's that when you look at the children who are in kinship arrangements, is that because of their culture, their family, or national, or regional, or?
Yeah. The difficulty is that kinship care, in terms of kind of studies and things like that, a lot of it's kind of very outcome focused. A lot of it doesn't kind of look into those things. The things that the when we look at kind of the what's it called? Come on, Dr. Paul, can't think of the word. not archaeology. What is it called? Looking back into
study of people groups.
Yes, throughout the ages. Anyways, those very important people. They
will be back for your doctor. Maybe I'll knock on the door. Gives it back.
But they look at kind of kinship care, you know, and that's the whole kind of it takes a village to raise a family, all of this kind of stuff. And there's kind of almost there's kind of a disconnect there. So social workers and social work research kind of goes down this path, and then we don't learn from other disciplines sometimes, when actually that's what we need to do. And I will really, really be really clear here and admit my failure in terms of I didn't properly consider race and ethnicity in my study. And that's, that's really, and when the murder of George Floyd, for example, really made me examine my whole world, as it should have hopefully made everyone examine the whole world. And I just don't think there's research there. So that's a really good research topic in terms of looking at culture and how that really, really impacts upon kind of kids.
Yeah. The reason I asked that is it came to my mind was because, like my wife and I, we've come from different family cultures. Her family is very much in and out of each other's houses all of the time. That grandchildren would stay with grandparents, like just for the weekend, just normal, no reason, just because that's what grandkids did. My family, totally opposite, very much nuclear family, you know, dog, Labrador, two kids, estate car. And so I found that, you know, we had a situation in our own family where there was a kind of like, is this going to happen? Are we going to turn into a kinship family, you know? And for me, that was like, oh, this is like I'm being hammered into a square hole. And my wife went, well, that's fine. It'll just happen. And it kind of really brought to me how that was just totally normal within that whole, because the whole family is like that. Because my family, we live in our little boxes.
Yeah.
Proper. Yeah. So there you go. That's your next doctorate, isn't it? Double
doctor. I can't be a doctor. Give me a beat. Like Gloria Estefan. No, I don't think so.
No, I
can't. Anyway, my partner wants, he keeps on saying, oh yeah, well, it's my turn for 4 years off. Like, I haven't been doing it. I've told you my work. And that doesn't work.
Breaking.
Well, have 4 years off and have some kids. I mean, you know.
Yeah, okay. Thanks.
Apparently, according to my partner, that's what I did for 4 years.
Oh, really?
Actually, yeah. So, yeah. I mean, yeah. You know, just saying.
Having my nieces overnight, I mean, it was great. Oh, if just in case my sister's listening, it was really, really great. But just not too often.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Fair enough. That's great. Yeah,
I think I'm just going to forget about having kids, to be honest.
It's not for everybody, let's face it.
Not for everyone.
No. Some of us are still on the fence. I shouldn't joke. No. This sort of thing, yeah. I think we should maybe call it quits. It's 10 to 9. You've given us, I think that this has been a really, I don't know about you, Scott, but it's, in the past we've talked about like kinship, we've had different people on, and it's kind of a well-worn conversation. That's not disrespectful to them, but it's a conversation needs to be had. This feels like it's been a really different conversation.
Yeah, very different.
Which has been really
very
refreshing.
That's
so
good.
Thank you.
And for that, Dr. Paul, thank you.
Yeah. Where can people read your thesis? If people are is there a short version?
There is a short version. No, you have to read the whole thing. You have to read the whole thing. But apparently it's a really easy read. It's a really, really nice read. My mum told me that, so it's not biased.
Yeah, of course. Our Paul, it's lovely. Of course it is.
If you just put in what matters to children living in kinship care, Paul Shuttleworth, Paul Daniel Shuttleworth, it should come up somewhere. And you just click on the link. I've honestly tried to make it as accessible as possible. There's no point in children giving their time for me and me, you know, getting so much information from kids, and it just not being accessible to other people. So I really do hope it's a good read, and I hope it's not just my mum being kind.
I'm sure it is. If I could ask you as well, when you're finished, if you could pop onto the Facebook page and there's a few comments there, and maybe you want to answer them, and that would be appreciated as well.
Of course.
So there you go. So, well, thank you very much, Paul. Dr. Paul. And we wish you well. Hope speak to you soon, because I think
that's your nickname now. Dr. Paul. The end.
Oh, dear.
Dr. Paul.
Well, on that note, I'm going to say goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bob and Jovi.